the origin of humanity. That's the theme of Psalm 139. It's the one creation text that really speaks most about the origin of a human species and the development of human civilization. So we'll be doing that. Not hearing. Let me... Nope, it's on. That's... Testing 3.14159. All right. 2653578. Got it? All right. Okay. Just to announce again, we're going to today launch into our series on the human origins, a theme that you see in Psalm 139. But last week was a banner week for discoveries on the history and the origin and history of advanced plants on the continental land masses. Something that creation's been wanting to find years. And as I've mentioned before in this class, the problem is that we've got a good fossil record for the animals, much more challenging to get that for the plants. Plants, after all, don't have bones. And bones are, you know, fairly easy to preserve compared to, say, plant parts. I mean, you do find petrified wood in various places, but, you know, trees haven't been around all that long in terms of being the dominant species around. But this past week, there were three separate articles published in Nature magazine. And in fact, we did a podcast on one of them, I think Thursday or Wednesday. Buzz Rana did a podcast. And it's on this paper here, Earth's Earliest Non-Marine Eukaryotes. Got the thing right here. And then there's a paper on the discovery of early eudicots. We'll define what that is. And then one on the biodiversity of plant life and how that fits in to understanding not only the history of plant life, but the history of advanced life, in particular human beings. All this actually fits into our discussion in the sense that we wouldn't be here unless there was a highly specified history of plants before us. And it's a specified history of plants that allows life on planet Earth to compensate for the increasing luminosity of the sun so that we human beings can come on the planet with just the right solar luminosity, with just the right solar stability. Remember last week we talked about how you know, there's a solar cycle that actually affects the health of human beings, and we happen to be here at that time when that solar cycle has the minimal impact on human health. If we were here at any other time, our health would be much more, well, in fact, we wouldn't be able to live as long as we do if we were here at a different time in the history of the sun. And so it's crucial that the plants get everything ready for human beings so that we can make it in that narrow window of time when the sun has the appropriate characteristics not only to make human life possible, but long human lives, which is crucial for launching civilization and fulfilling the Great Commission, taking the good news of Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world. And but this has been a serious apologetics issue, literally for hundreds of years, because skeptics have been very quick to critique Genesis 1 and saying Genesis 1 puts plants at the beginning or the first part of creation day 3, and we have no scientific evidence to support that. Now, you could always respond by saying, well, that's because the evidence is hard to come by. Another way to respond is to say, well, you know, if you're going to have animals on the planet, you're going to need plants to support those animals. So the fact that we can't find the evidence for the plants doesn't mean they're not there. Something's got to be on the continents so that the animals that are living on the continents can eat. If there's no plants on the continents, then what are the animals eating? And so in that sense, the skeptics, I think, have been raising a straw man argument for these past 200 years. But if you go back to the German higher critics at the beginning of the 19th century, that was one of their big skeptical charges against taking the creation accounts in the Bible literally, saying it's impossible to reconcile what we see in these creation accounts with the fossil record. But of course, in the days of Charles Darwin, the fossil record was largely incomplete. That's something that Charles Darwin himself readily admitted, that the fossil record was woefully incomplete, and he said, the test of my model will be what happens to my model as the fossil record becomes more and more complete. Now, one thing that already has put the Darwinian model in huge trouble is the fact that he predicted that the fossil record would reveal a gradual process of life going from simple to complex, and now we know it's not a gradual process, it's a step function. And so here in America, at least, there's been a replacement of the gradualist Darwinian paradigm with the models put out by Stephen Gould and Niles Eldridge, punctuated equilibria, which is the idea that life remains stagnant for tens of millions of years, and then you see this rapid burst of evolution to a new level, then it remains stagnant again. Of course, the Europeans and the Africans who are into a naturalistic evolutionary model have been very critical of Gould and Eldridge, saying, don't you guys realize you're falling into a creationist trap? In the sense that if you punctuate all the evolution in a very narrow window of time, there is no naturalistic mechanism to get that much evolution squished into that short of a period of time. Moreover, you're not just stuck once, you're stuck repeatedly. So, but this is all kind of a background to what about the plants? The Bible tells us that as soon as God creates the continental landmasses, creation day three, that's the beginning of creation day three, the latter part of creation day three, God fills the continental landmasses with plants. Now, maybe we can dim the lights a bit because these slides are, especially with all the light coming in here. Yeah, that'll be better. Part of the higher critique, German critique, is based on the fact that when Genesis 1 speaks about let the lands produce plants, it uses a very generic word for let the land produce plants. It's a word that we've actually seen here in some of our creation psalms that literally refers to all green plants. And so that would even include the unicellular cyanobacteria would be included in the biblical reference to plants. But then what you see in Genesis 1, it says, let the land produce plants, and then it kind of breaks it down and talks about seeds, trees, and fruit. Now, the thing to notice here is that these are simply examples of the broader term for plants. Genesis 1 is not giving us a complete breakdown of all the categories of plants that fit under the generic term for the green plant life. So green plant life, and here are three different kinds of green plant life. So that's how we are to understand Genesis 1, creation day 3. It's not giving us an exhaustive list of all the specified kinds of plants that fit under the generic term, but it does give us examples, namely seeds, trees, and fruit. However, this is true of both the German translations of the Bible and the English translations of the Bible. Seeds, trees, and fruit immediately gives the connotation of highly advanced plants, and the fossil record tells us these plants have only been here since the tertiary era. Tertiary era refers to that time in the history of the Earth after the giant asteroid struck the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico and wiped out the dinosaurs. So it's the post-dinosaur era where we see unambiguous fossil evidence for plants that have seeds, trees, and fruits, kind of like we would understand in the English translation, namely advanced flowering plants, you know, where you get apple trees. Apple trees have seeds, they have fruit, we see them as trees. However, as I've mentioned before here in the class, when you actually look at these words in the original Hebrew language, they're far more generic than they are in, say, the European language translations. The word for seed is the word zerah, and it means the embryos of organisms, where organisms is a generic term. In fact, it could actually refer to animal seed as well as plant seed. And the truth is, every green plant produces these embryos. So, in the original Hebrew, this phrase seed is completely generic to all plants. That's not true of the word for trees. The word for trees is the word etz, and it means any large plant containing stiff fibers. So we think of redwood trees or apple trees, Actually, in the Hebrew language, you'd also have to include things like cauliflower, broccoli, lettuce, celery would be included. Any plant that produces any kind of a fiber would be in that category. That would also include plants that we see in the oceans that we know have been here for a very long period of time. Anything that produces any kind of stiff structure would be included. So we look at an English and we think woody trees that are, you know, 10 to several hundred feet high, whereas in the Hebrew language it could refer to very tiny plants that just had some capacity to produce these fibers. And then we have the word for fruit, and in the Hebrew it means food made by the organisms. Now, all plants, green plants, produce food. That's what green plants do. They take carbon dioxide and water from the environment, and through photosynthesis, they convert that into sugars, starches, and fats, and that would be true of all green plants. So in the Hebrew, this is a generic to all plants, as is seed. This one is not generic to all plants, but keep in mind what Genesis 1 is saying is giving us a broad word for all plants, and is giving us three examples, not necessarily an exhaustive list. And it's all, you know, let the land produce plants. Now, this is personal for me because when we debated Michael Shermer and several atheist science professors at the University of Texas a couple of years ago in front of 3,000 students and faculty, Michael Shermer spent his entire speaking time critiquing Genesis 1. By the way, that was not his mandate. His mandate was to respond to the biblical creation model that Fuzz and I had laid out, and we'd agreed ahead of time that in presenting our model, we'd stick strictly to the science. And Shermer was to respond in similar fashion. He chose not to do so, knowing that we would have no chance to respond to what he had to say. And so he basically spent his entire time bashing Genesis 1. And a large chunk of that time was bashing the events of creation day 3. He made a big deal about the fact that, you know, the fossil record is clear, animals come first, plants come second. Well, there were several people in the audience kind of scratching their head and saying, well, if there are no plants, what are the animals eating? But, you know, he is right in the sense that at the time of that debate, I think it was April of 2008, we had not had any undisputed fossil evidence or isotope evidence for the count of the land masses proliferating with these green plants. That did change with an article published in Nature in 2009. This was just 6 months after our debate. That's one thing I shared privately with Shermer afterwards. It says, look, this evidence that you're wanting will soon be forthcoming. You're trying to argue your case on the lack of evidence, but it's not an impossible lack of evidence. Just wait and it'll be forthcoming. Well, literally within months. We had this paper published by Knopf and Kennedy in Nature. And basically what these two gentlemen did is show that we had difficulty coming up with fossil evidence, but we do have isotope evidence. And they gave several isotope signatures that showed that the continental land masses were just as prolific with photosynthetic life for 200 million years before the Cambrian explosion as for 200 million years after the Cambrian explosion. And in one sense, this is something we must have already known, because in the 200 million years before the Cambrian explosion, the oxygen content in the atmosphere went from 5% up to 10%. Something had to be driving that great increase in oxygen. You're not going to get that without the proliferation of photosynthetic plant life on the continental land masses. But now we had undisputed evidence through the isotope signatures that indeed photosynthetic activity, plant life, was just as abundant in the continental land masses before as after the Cambrian explosion. And this is something that Shermer made a big deal about, saying all the evidence is post-Cambrian, none of the evidence is pre-Cambrian. Well, now we have the pre-Cambrian evidence. And just this past few days, this paper got published in Nature by Strother et al., making the point that we now have undisputed fossil evidence of abundant plant life on the Kananda land masses, moreover, advanced plant life on the Kananda land masses, not just the primitive stuff. And it's referring to a group of shales that they found in various parts of the world. Basically, what this research team did is said, okay, if we're going to try to find fossils of plant life, what's the easiest place to find them? And they discovered that there was these shale deposits that date between 1.2 and 1.0 billion years old that would have the best likelihood of preserving plant fossils. So they basically went around the world and dug up those shale deposits and began to look for the fossils. And here's what they found. They found fossils of multicellular structures. So what they were showing is that it's not just the unicellular photosynthetic life, but there is multicellular structures. They found complex walled cysts and asymmetric organic structures. And the significance of the cysts and the asymmetric structures is that can't happen unless you've got specialized plant organs. And so, for example, if you look at a tree, you've got the leaves, you've got the stems, you've got the roots, you've got the xylem and the phylum. These are all different structures that are somewhat akin to what you see in an animal body of significant size, where you've got skin, where you've got kidneys, you've got a heart, you've got a lung. We're seeing specialized structures. And so this is what was really significant about their research. They had undisputed fossil evidence for these specialized, different specialized structures in these plants. Now, the biggest thing they found was about 1 millimeter across. So these aren't big. And they kind of explained that, saying, you know, again, plants are not like animals. They don't preserve well. And at best, all we're going to do is find small pieces of the plant. We're not going to find the entire plant. It's not like finding a T-Rex where you can get almost the entire skeleton intact in the fossil record. It says the geological forces on the Earth are so powerful and plants so fragile that it will be broken up. And this is actually quite amazing that we got pieces that remain for this period of time that are as big as a centimeter across. But in looking at these things, they were finding different structures, saying 1.0 to 1.2 billion years. So now, they did mention in the paper they can actually come up with more precise dates, but their initial study was simply to look at these shale formations that all date to that period all over the world, and dig it into the fine fossils. I mean, we could actually go back there and try to do radiometric dating of those shale deposits and come up with more precise dates. But their goal was to establish that here we have clear-cut, undisputed fossil evidence for advanced plants that date back to much earlier than this previous study here. This study only went back 800 million years. This one takes you back to 1.2 billion years, so it's pushing it back by 400 million years. Now, say, can we go back any earlier? Going back any earlier is going to be a real problem, because what these researchers were saying is, okay, we can see all these different geological layers. These are geological layers where we know it's going to be virtually hopeless to find the fossils because of the very active geology. They did find this one layer between 1.0 and 1.2 billion, where they said we got the best chance. So going earlier is going to be a challenge. Although if we go back really early, you might find some stable places in Australia and South Africa. But that would be like 3 to 3.5 billion years ago, where we already have evidence that that's a period of time when only unicellular life can survive, or colonies of unicellular life. So in that sense, it's not worth going back that early. Yes.
I think you just answered my question here, but you're talking about a billion to 1.3 billion years back from the present, not after the formation.
Okay, yeah, back from the present. 1.0 to 1.2 billion years from today.
Okay, and why do they know these are plants, photosynthetic devices, rather than what we would consider more animal-type life or other?
Well, that was a big part of their study, establishing that these were really plant structures, not animal structures. And so, you know, you can listen to the podcast from Fuzz. He's more into the biological sciences than I am. But, you know, as I read the paper, I didn't have any doubts that these were really plant structures. Neither did the reviewer. There was multiple authors on the paper, and they literally surveyed not just one deposit, but several deposits. So I think they've really made a strong case. This got a lot of news on the web, so this has been quite well vetted. And it's an amazing discovery because it literally pushes back the evidence for these advanced plants, literally 400 million years earlier than we've been able to do before. And this study didn't have fossils. All they had was isotope evidence. Now we've got fossils, actual fossils. Or I should put it more accurately, they got pieces of the fossils. Again, you know, taking the analogy of finding, say, an intact mastodon and the La Brea tar pits is one thing. Sometimes, you know, we put together a discovery of a dinosaur based on one or two bones. And like with human origins, often we establish a species with only two or three small bone structures. Well, this is more dramatic than that. You're establishing the existence of significant plant species that could be, you know, fairly large size, but all you've got left are the small pieces. So, and it's just the fact that we live in a planet with a lot of geological activity. Now, what I want to share with you are some additional discoveries that show you why we must have a combination of advanced plants and lots of geological activity to get things ready for human beings. So that's the tie-in to our lesson today. But go ahead.
Since human beings or hominids go back 3 or 4 million years, I mean, you would have to have plants along with man, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, the plants don't go away.
Yeah, so they go back at least as far as that.
Well, there's, you know, scientists have never disputed the existence of advanced plants in the post-dinosaur era. So the dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago, and from that period onward, we have the Earth filled with these advanced plants, the most, you know, just as advanced as the plants we see on the planet today. What is different, though, is we have a greater diversity today than we had when the dinosaurs went extinct. But yeah, if you're talking the bipedal primates, they've been around 6.5 million years, and throughout that time, plants weren't a problem. So they've been here. Yes.
I thought fruit trees have been brought back to about 375 million years ago, and seed-bearing plants to.
You've got conifers going back to 375 million years ago. Apple trees don't go back that far. Although, that's the next paper I'm going to be talking about, is that we've now been able to push back advanced flowering plants about 50 million years, 60 million years earlier than we've been able to do before. This is a paper also published in Nature with the title, A Eudicot from the Early Cretaceous of China. And so I was looking in one of those famous fossil beds in eastern China, and they've now discovered eudicots for the first time dating as early as 125 million years ago. So that's a significant discovery. Now, what's happening is they're actually pushing back these dates for the history of the development of advanced plants much earlier than we have before. Now, what I'm showing here is kind of a field of ferns. This is kind of what we have good evidence that these kinds of plants literally date back 400 million years. What dated before that was too broken up for us to really tell. So 400 million years ago, we actually can tell that exactly what kind of plant, how big they were. And then once you get into the post-dinosaur era, then we know we got the kind of flowering plants that we're all used to, where you got trees, conifers, deciduous trees, and all kinds of flowering plants low in the ground, proliferating the planet Earth. What is new is that we have this paper coming out of China, written by four Chinese paleontologists, that tell us that this picture we see here, we can now push back to about 125 million years. Now, again, we're talking fragile plant structures. I mean, if you're talking plants like this, they don't survive well. I mean, all of you know. You go out and pick some flowers and give it to your wife or your girlfriend, how long do they last? Yeah, a few days and they're gone. And so trying to find them 125 million years later could be a real problem. Even trying to find the wood. I mean, you look at these petrified forests that you see, they're all relatively young. They don't date back that old. They go back 100 or 200 million years. Then beyond that, the stone or the petrified material gets broken up. We live on a very geologically active planet. And so it's difficult to trace the history of fragile life very early just because of the fact that things get recycled. By the way, that's my whole point. The recycling of animal and plant tissue is crucial to prepare things for human beings. But what they found dating back 125 million years ago were eudicots. You say, what's a eudicot? Well, probably you remember your high school botany class where they talked about monocots and dicots. Anybody remember that? Monocots and dicots?
I remember it.
You remember it. an apricot is a dicot, right? But a monocot is kind of a plant that produces a seed that doesn't have any bilateral structure to it. I mean, if you look at a pea, for example, you can split it into two. And it's kind of got two halves with two somewhat mirror structures. A monocot's not like that. It's just kind of a single blob of a seed. But, you know, what's happening in these botanical literature is that they now take these dicots and have subdivided them into different categories based on the pollen structures. And so a eudicot are dicots. All eudicots are dicots. But eudicots are dicots where the pollen structures have at least three or more spores. And this is true of all of the truly advanced plants on the planet today. In fact, eudicots make up 70% of the plant species on the planet today. But the thinking was that before the end of the dinosaur era, that they were making up less than 10%, maybe 0%. We now know, thanks to his discovery in China, that they were actually not as common as they were today, and not as many species, but they were here. They were here 125 million years ago. And then there's a third paper in Nature. So that's this paper by by Sun et al., the Chinese. Then there's a paper written by a single author, Bradley Cardnell, and what he did was almost a laboratories type study, is that he was looking at different species of biofilms. So he had this laboratory setup, must have been quite large, where he had one tank where he had just a few species of biofilms, another tank where he had a few more, and he basically had these different tanks, 10 or 12 different tanks where he had different numbers and kinds of species of biofilms. And what he was testing is this. He says, you know, ecologists for a long time, all the way back to Darwin himself, have presumed that the greater diversity you have of species, the better it is. Now, Darwin never defined how it would be better. He just presumed it would be better. But there's been research in the last 10 years suggesting that if you've got greater plant diversity, this is going to mean a more efficient recycling of nutrients. And so what Bradley Cardnell did is to actually run an experiment to test that hypothesis and basically prove that the hypothesis is correct, that if you've got a tank with a maximum number of different species of biofilms, it very efficiently recycles, in particular, the nitrogen and the nitrates. And where you only have a few species, it doesn't do a very good job at all. Now, what's exciting about this study is that we can show over the past 50 million years that the diversity of advanced plants has gone steadily upward, which means that over the past 50 million years, the efficiency with which plants recycle nutrients has gone steadily upward. It also tells us that the capacity of plants to accelerate the erosion of the continental land masses likewise has gone steadily upward. Now, why that's important is based on something we talked about last week. Remember that paper we talked about where we mentioned that, you know, we have an 11-year solar cycle, and when you're at the peak of the solar cycle, there are 6 different health factors for men that degrade, and the 6 different health factors for the female cervix that degrades. Not a whole lot, but we can measure some degradation in both male and female health. The good news is that we happen to be living on a star that's got the minimum amplitude of the sunspot cycle. And it's got the minimum flaring activity. So we're living at the healthiest time in the history of the sun. That's good to know. And incidentally, that window of optimal solar health for human existence only lasts 100,000 years. So there's a reason why a creator would want to bring human beings upon the face of the earth exactly 4.5662 billion years after the solar system is formed. If you make it 4.5661 or 4.5663, you're in trouble. You have to be very precise about this. And as we mentioned last week, you also want to be, I don't know how that keystone got there, but okay, here we go. There's an optimal luminosity for human beings. In fact, if you go a little bit below, a little bit above, it's impossible for humans to exist on the Earth. And so this is what you want to aim for in terms of bringing human beings on the face of the Earth. As mentioned last week, looks like it could be here as well. But if you're right there, that's when the sun is in a very unstable phase, where you've got an enormous sunspot cycle, lots of flaring activity. Stars, as we mentioned last week, are like human beings. They're most stable when they're middle-aged, not when they're young or when they're old. They want to have them when they're middle-aged. And so this is when the sun is middle-aged. In fact, it's almost exactly middle-aged. The sun can burn for 9 billion years. 4.57 billion years is when you get maximum stability. But it's also the same time you get the best possible luminosity. However, you have a problem, is that life on planet Earth can only tolerate about a 2% change in the luminosity of the sun. So here's the sun getting dimmer and getting brighter. I mean, we have life showing up about here when the sun's getting dimmer, then it turns around and gets brighter. During this phase, the sun is losing mass, and you know, the luminosity of a star goes up to the 4th power of the mass, and so only needs to lose a little bit of mass before it has a major impact on the brightness of the star. But there comes a time when the sun stops losing significant mass, and then it gets brighter and brighter as it continues to convert hydrogen into helium in its core, which means that about 10 million years from now, it'll be impossible to have human beings on the face of the Earth in any technological form, never mind high technology in any form that we couldn't possibly exist. The sun will simply be too bright. Now, what's been keeping life possible on the surface of the Earth is the fact that life plays a role in regulating the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So during this period, the Creator can put life on the planet, different life at different times, so that the life is pumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So as the sun's getting cooler and cooler, the atmosphere is getting progressively more and more efficient in trapping heat from the sun, so the temperature in the surface of the Earth can be kept ideal for both animal life and plant life. But then the Creator's got to turn things around, because instead of the sun getting dimmer, it's now getting brighter. And so we see a change in the kinds of life forms that the Creator chooses to keep on the surface of the Earth, life forms that will take greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere instead of adding them to the atmosphere. And this keeps going along. So as the sun gets brighter and brighter, we have these life forms becoming progressively more efficient in removing greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. Now, there's 2 ways this can work. You can make the photosynthetic activity more aggressive. And so, for example, you pack the oceans with more plant life, and you begin to pack the continental landmasses with more plant life. And the greater the diversity, the more plant life you can put on the planet. So it explained why the fossil record shows increasing diversity and also shows a transition from plants that are non-flowering plants to flowering plants. The flowering plants are far more efficient in pulling carbon dioxide and water out of the atmosphere and converting them into sugar, starches, and fats. Water is a greenhouse gas. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. So the more that stuff plants pull out of the atmosphere, the less capable the atmosphere will be for trapping heat from the sun. Now, at the same time, as we showed you last week, the continents are getting bigger and bigger. Now, with the continents getting bigger and bigger, that means you've got increasing capacity to erode those continental land masses down. Now, I'm not going to go into the chemistry again. We covered this 6 months ago, if you all remember. I kind of showed you kind of how the chemistry works, that if you've got rain falling on the continental land masses, then that rain will chemically react with the carbon dioxide to make carbonates and sand and pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And so we start off with silicates. That's what continental land masses are. What's happening at the earthquake fault zones is that basalts are being converted into silicates. And the silicates are lighter than the basalts, so they begin to build up and they float above the basalts, and that's how you get the growth of the continental land masses. As time goes by, the continents get bigger and bigger through the conversion of basalts into silicates. It's the erosion of the silicates into sand and carbonates that pulls carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And so as the continents get bigger and bigger, you can get greater and greater conversion of the silicates into carbon into carbonates and sand. Now notice that there's a couple of benefits here. Silicates are not a very good building material for human civilization. Sand is. Carbonates are. And so this has been very good for the launch of human civilization. We're taking these useless silicates and converting them into sands and carbonates. At the same time, we're pulling greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. And with bigger continents, you get more erosion taking place. Now, what scientists have discovered in the past, 20, 25 years, is that plants can hasten or slow down the erosion of the continental land masses. So, for example, the flowering plants are much more efficient, about a factor of four times more efficient at speeding up the erosion of the continental land masses than the non-flowering plants. And these eudicotes that we're talking about are more efficient than the non-eudicotic dicots, and the dicots are more efficient than the monocots. So you can actually see a rationale for the buildup of different kinds of plant species with respect to time. Because as you begin to approach the human era, you're going to want that erosion process on the continental land masses to speed up for two reasons. You're going to want to pump more oxygen in the atmosphere. That's what these more efficient plants will do. You want to pull more carbon dioxide and water to the atmosphere in order to keep the planet cool enough for human life, but you also want to build up huge quantities of sand and carbonates that humans can mine to make freeways, for example, and skyscrapers and all that good stuff. So that's what was happening in these last 3 weeks, or the last 2 weeks, is the publication of these three papers that are actually giving us, for the first time, a detailed understanding of the history of plants on planet Earth. And by the way, I'm the one that added, you know, what this means for human civilization. There's no comment in any of these papers about how this affects the increasing luminosity of the sun or the erosion rate, but that's something that we've been writing about at Reasons to Believe for about 15 years, is that, this is a very integrated plan on the part of the Creator to make sure we got just the plants that humans are going to need showing up at the right time with those plants, transforming the atmosphere at just the right pace and the right time, at the same time providing us with the resources that we need, all in good stead so that we arrive here with the resources that we need, the atmosphere that we need, at that narrow window of time when the sun makes it possible for us to exist on this planet in a civilized state. Yes?
How do these plants appearing at these times you're talking about, what's the time frame in that relative to the formation of the coal beds and the oil deposits? Are they the major contributor to those based on this research? Would that be consistent with that?
Well, the Cambrian and post-Cambrian animals are the biggest contributor to our petroleum and natural gas deposits. And we talked about that last week, how we're living at the ideal petroleum moment, where if we were here earlier or later, we wouldn't have as much petroleum that we could mine. The coal comes predominantly from plant species. And, you know, it's both the monocotes and the dicotes that contribute to the coal deposits. And, you know, there's different kinds of coal. You've got lignite, you've got bituminous, you've got anthracite. But we're living at a time when we have all three in quite plentiful supply. So, yes?
So if this red line continues, that means the ocean has to evaporate more? Or is this plate tectonics going to be like one huge continent like it was before, many millions of years ago, when there was one big continent?
Yeah, if we project out in the future, there will be continued slow growth of the continental landmass coverage of our planet. Right now it's at 29%. In the future, it's going to go to 30%, 31%, 32%. And that will be a problem for advanced life. 29% is the ideal amount if you're talking global human civilization. That's the best in terms of getting the most efficient reprocessing of the nutrients. And this is what allows the greatest diversity of plant and animal life to exist. So 29%, you're going to have the maximum diversity the planet can possibly sustain. So again, it's evidence we're here at the ideal time. And this is all planned. This is not something that's accidental. Yes?
What's the time frame on the 29 to 30 to 31 projected forward?
Okay. What geophysicists project is that what you see here will continue on into the future. So we're looking at slow growth. We're not going to get anything like this happening. From now on, it's going to be slow.
So when does it go, 29 to 30? 100 million years? 4 billion years?
Yeah, you're probably looking at something in order of 100 million years to pick up an extra percent. After all, I mean, it's taken us about that time to go from 28 to 29. So roughly, you're going to pick up an extra percent every 100 million years. It's a little bit complicated to calculate what's going to happen in the future because our planet is slowing down its rotation rate. A slow rotation rate means less erosion. So the continents won't erode quite as quickly. But we're also seeing that the plate tectonic activity is subsiding. And so we're not going to have as aggressive plate tectonics in the future, which means the continents will grow more slowly, but they won't erode as quickly either. So that's why we're in a slow growth period and have been in a slow growth period for the last half billion years. In the back.
I've always wondered about the progression from lizards, cold-blooded animals, to warm-blooded animals. So the oxygen was lower, I suppose, because those animals didn't need such high metabolism. Right?
Yeah, dinosaurs don't need as much oxygen as, say, birds. But we do start seeing birds at about 150 million years ago.
What was the oxygen like then?
Okay. Let me see if I can pull that up for you. We actually showed you that last week, but let me see if I can get that for you. Yeah, here we go. So this is how oxygen increased throughout the history of the Earth, and this was all... Yeah. Why it went up so fast? This is when you start getting the flowering plants. You know, they're much more efficient at producing oxygen than the plants that existed before, so you get a big increase. However, this increase is a bit deceptive because, you know, we're squishing everything down. Actually, there's some significant changes taking place through here. So over the last, say, 200 million years, it's changing between 17 and about 22%. And that doesn't make a whole lot of difference. If you're at 17%, you can still be a bird and fly through the sky. Not as easily as you can when it's at 21%. That's where it is today, but it doesn't rule out the possibility of birds. It just means that we can have more birds today than we had, say, 150 million years ago, and bigger birds. But if you get too much oxygen, this is also a problem. Too much oxygen in the atmosphere means that you're going to have things burning, and that would include us. I remember back in the late 1960s, the college craze was to go to an oxygen bar. You know, where you go to a place and you breathe pure oxygen and you really feel good. You don't see oxygen bars anymore because we now realize it's a health risk. Because when you start breathing pure oxygen, your body basically burns up more efficiently. So it's not a good thing. In fact, when I was growing up, a couple of my dad's friends were test pilots for the Canadian Air Force. And back in the 1950s, they would give them pure oxygen to breathe when they were up there at 40,000 feet. And none of them lived past the age of 52. Their bodies basically just burnt out. So we don't give our test pilots pure oxygen anymore. So, but the real problem, if you get, say, even at 23% oxygen instead of 21% oxygen, grass and forest fires begin to run out of control. And by the way, you do need grass and forest fires. They're good. Without grass and forest fires, you can't recycle the carbon back to the continental land masses. So it's important that we have a significant amount of charcoal in our continental land mass soils. And it takes forest and grass fires to make that happen. And basically what you want for most continental land mass areas, it depends on the geology, but something between, say, every 8 years to every 100 years, you want a fire. And, you know, we've now run into issues where we prevented fires for over 100 years and realized that actually damages the plant ecosystem. But you don't want a fire every year. You know, here in our mountains, kind of what's ideal is every 8 or 9 years. But in a wet forest, you want it happening, say, every 40 years. Yes?
I have a question. A younger friend of mine, talking to yesterday, came up with his, he's been kind of progressing, and he's been looking at your website, checking things back and forth, but he had a tripper he wanted to throw to me that their camp thinks they've found fossil beds that have animals in progressive layers, but going through that whole bed, a fossilized tree murdered them.
Yeah, that's a common argument that they've made, but it's based on a fallacy. That the idea is that the old Earth view only accepts gradual processes, and the young Earth view only accepts catastrophic processes. The truth is that in the old Earth view, we would recognize a combination of a catastrophic and gradual processes, and therefore there is the possibility that a tree could be embedded in multiple layers of catastrophic events. So
yeah, I know I've seen they've found some fossil beds where there's quite a bit of vertical jump, but it was from, as you say, a catastrophic flood that, like Pompeii, brought in an enormous death in one disaster event. And maybe these were, they found dinosaurs almost like in a vertical pit, as if it was a
Well, keep in mind that, you know, these layers get, piled on top of one another through gradual events, sometimes a combination of gradual and catastrophic events. Then you get major tectonic activity that flips the whole thing upside down. You know, younger creations will say, well, sometimes the younger stuff is below the older stuff. Well, plate tectonics will do that. It'll actually fold the layers and turn them upside down. And so you can actually see a reverse history as you drill down. But you'll also get some evidence of that extreme tectonic activity in the same layer. By the way, a friend of mine went on one of these young Earth tours down the Grand Canyon, and the young Earth creationist geologists kept pointing out all these catastrophic layers where things were laid down quickly. What my friend did, so what about that layer in between those two? And they always change the subject. And what he was kind of doing was pointing out look, you're being selective. All you're doing is pointing out the Grand Canyon layers where you get catastrophic events. Those are evidences where every geologist would recognize that's a gradual deposition, not a rapid deposition. And so a lot of the young Earth evidences for a young Earth are based on a simplistic look at the science, or a selective look, where they only look at pieces of the evidence, they don't look at the whole of the evidence. By the way, you can get online, there's several really good articles for why we're going to see fossilized structures going through several layers. And there's a variety of mechanisms that can produce that.
He claimed he couldn't find a response to that.
Oh, that's not true. There's all kinds of very good responses that are easily available on the web. Even Wikipedia lists them. So, well, if Wikipedia's got it, then you know it's pretty common knowledge. Yes.
This was on the Sun's luminosity thing, how that arc really...
Right.
Let
me see if I can pull that up for you. Yeah, it's going to continue to go up. In fact, it will go up to such a point that the sun will vaporize the Earth. So things are going to get bad in the future. I can guarantee that.
Well, that part of Revelation where it talks about how it, like, you know, men are going to be scorched because it's so hot. And I thought, gosh, if it's that hot, things are going to be like...
Okay, when the book of Revelation talks about the heat of the sun scorching men in the last days, it's not referring to this. I mean, before we get to really uncomfortable temperatures, we're looking at a million years from now. And I believe that there's good textual evidence that Revelation is referring to events a lot closer in history than a million years hence. Although I'll tell you this, I've met theologians at the leading seminaries who are claiming that Revelation won't be fulfilled for another 3 million years. And, I was actually spoke at one of those seminaries and says, just look at this. We're not going to make it that long. So,
what is that called in theology?
Oh, no. It's referred to as amillennialism. And, there's a group of amillennialists that take a pessimistic view of how long it's going to take the Lord to get things all set up so that he can take over the planet. And not all amillennialists are saying 3 million years. But they're typically projecting out a lot longer in time than the premillennial interpretation. You know, premillennialists are saying decades, centuries, maybe 1,000 or 2,000 years, where it's common for amillennialists to say 100,000 years or 1 million years. But yeah, I've been communicating with these theologians saying there's no way you can push it even another 10,000 years forward, let alone 1 million years. When Revelation speaks about the sun, the heat of the sun scorching men, I believe it's an atmosphere effect. In other words, we're going to see the heat-trapping capacity of Earth's atmosphere go up sufficiently that it doesn't matter what's happening to the sun. If our atmosphere is trapping more heat, it's going to mean scorching heat for those on the surface of the Earth. And so... Yeah, I've had people send me articles saying in 2012 we're going to get scorching heat. Well, a few extra sunspots on the sun is not going to give us scorching heat. Yes?
Do you think human activity can affect the shape of the curve?
Human activity can affect this curve, no, but it can affect the heat-trapping capacity of Earth's atmosphere. I mean, this is kind of the global warming debate. Is human activity significantly causing the heat-trapping capacity of the atmosphere to go up? By the way, that point is not disputed. What is disputed is to what degree is human activity responsible for the extra heat-trapping capacity of the atmosphere, and to what degree should we be blaming it on natural cycles of the Earth? Because, you know, as the Earth orbits about the sun, its orbit changes. And the changes in the orbit will affect the degree to which we have hotter summers and colder winters. There's no doubt that human activity is significant. I mean, just to show you the figures, before the Industrial Revolution, we had 275 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's a greenhouse gas. It's now sitting at about 350 parts per million. So, and that's extra 75 parts is easily attributed to human activity. Although, I will say this, it's not necessarily the automobile or the factories. We now know that in terms of human contributions, greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel burning ranks number 3 in the list. Number 1 in the list are all the cows that we bred. And the cows are very efficient emitters of greenhouse gas, especially those that we bred for very high dairy product production. They just emit huge amounts of methane and carbon dioxide to the atmosphere.
McDonald's is causing it.
Well, maybe it's the Dairy Queen. So, you know, the amazing thing is, we've now bred Holstein cows so that they produce more than 80 quarts of milk a day.
And,
well, I think the record is 88 quarts a day. Whereas before we started breeding the Holsteins, they were producing just a few quarts of milk a day. Now they're producing literally more than 80 quarts. But in order to get it up to 80, what we've done is we've made these cows much more efficient emitters of greenhouse gases. And then the other problem is that we've had to cut down our forests to make pasture lands for all these cows. And now the cutting down of the forest means that you don't have as efficient removal of carbon dioxide and water from the atmosphere. It's forests that are the big remover in terms of plant life on the continents of greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. You've had your hand up a long time. Go for it.
You said it's okay to 180 degree turn in segues.
Yeah, you can do that. I'm all right with that.
Okay. Speaking of Adam and Eve, when God created Adam, before he committed the sin of eating the apple, in the Garden of Eden, did they have to really do anything, or was everything provided for them? I mean, do you know what I mean? Did they have to work the land, or God just...
Here's an analogy. It's like you being given a home where you got nothing but dirt in the backyard, and then you got to figure out how to landscape it, as opposed to buying a house where they brought in a team of Japanese gardeners and they turned it into a beautiful, well-manicured place. Which one is going to be easier to work with? Well, obviously the one that's been pre-manicured, and where all the plants are in there and it's beautiful. But I'll tell you this, even the best engineered, landscaped garden takes maintenance. And that's what God told Adam. He put him in the garden. By the way, Adam was created outside the Garden of Eden. So he got to see what it's like to have a landscape that's basically dirt and wild plants. Then God put him in the Garden of Eden and beautifully manicured. Everything was just wonderful. All laid out, just the right species of plant where you want them. And then God said, take care of it. Which meant he had to be the gardener. He had to maintain it in the condition that God gave it to him. And in the Garden of Eden, the second law of thermodynamics was fully in effect, just as it is today. And so there would be decay going on. You know, I'm going to have to do yard work today, even though I did it last Sunday. Why? Because there's been significant decay that's taken place over the last 7 days. So I've got to go back there and try to maintain it. So, but obviously Adam had a much easier job in the Garden of Eden than when God ejected him from the Garden of Eden, where God said to Adam and Eve, see this wonderful garden? Plant your own.
So did he send them basically from the Garden of Eden to, say, I don't know, Pittsburgh?
Probably not as bad as Pahrump. So
he had it good, and then when he sinned, he basically vanished him to where? To just
he was ejected from the garden. So he was no longer in the garden, he was outside the garden.
How does God eject them? Does he just
he kinda gave him the boot. He gave him an eviction notice. So
and then he had to. Now what if Adam never ate that tree of good and evil? What would have what where would we be now if he never did that? Because somebody down the line probably would have screwed up. I mean, if it wasn't him, it would have been somebody else. Or, I mean,
well, you know, theologians have speculated about that. What if Adam and Eve had not rebelled against their Creator? Well, you're right. Probably one of their kids or grandkids or great-great-grandkids would. Now you'd have a situation where you got two different kinds of people on the planet. Those that are without sin and those that are in sin. And that would make for a more complex theological problem from God's perspective. So, you know, theologians have argued that what actually happened in the garden enabled a simpler, more direct, more rapid solution to the problem of evil and suffering. And something we've written about in Why the Universe is the Way It Is, keep in mind that God wanted to resolve the problem of evil and suffering, not just for humanity, but for the angels. And not just for the angels, but for all the life that He intends to create in the new creation. And so, we humans can look at this problem of evil a lot more simplistically than God looks at it. He wants a complete solution. Often we're content with a partial solution.
What's the difference between God creating Adam and God begetting Jesus? I mean, was Jesus considered the second Adam? I mean, did God say to Jesus, look, Adam, he may not do what I want him to do. I want you to pitch hit. I want you to go in that bullpen and warm up, and I'm going to send you down. You're going to have an incredible life, but I'll be cross with you for about 3 hours. And then,
Well, no, you're on to something. Paul referred to Adam, or Jesus, as the second Adam. But he showed the difference. Adam sinned, the second Adam did not sin. Adam was purely human, the second Adam was not only human, but God as well. And because he was the God-man, he could do something Adam could not do, which was actually redeem all of humanity for the offenses they committed against God. Now, when it tells us in Colossians that he is the only begotten of the Father, a lot of people get the idea that he was created like Adam was created. But when it talks about him being the only begotten and the firstborn from the dead, it's referring to the fact that the first one to be raised bodily from the dead, in a sin-free capacity, was Jesus. And he was the first one to be raised with this from an imperishable body into a perishable body into an imperishable body, and that we would follow. So he is the first one to experience the resurrection. It wasn't that he was created. He's an uncreated being. He's always existed. He's eternal. And so if you read Colossians 1:15-18, it's quite clear what it means by begotten. And this is something that theologians have written about for centuries, as to what exactly is intended by that.
So Jesus was supposed to be around for eternity. I mean, it's
He's eternity past. He was never created.
So he's eternity past, present, future. He's
correct.
So the he led a life, he's God, but he also led a life as a human. Came down and led the life as a human. And then he was crucified, and that was excruciating. And then he went back to the Father, to God, and live in paradise. So, again, I don't quite get this whole thing with him taking on all the sins of mankind, and all of a sudden, as long as we believe in it, we're okay. I still don't get it.
Well, a number of skeptics have made that interesting point. They just say, look, he only spent 9 hours on the cross. How could he possibly atone for the sins of 50, 60, 70 billion people in those 9 hours?
You're saying it was 9 billion eternities in another dimension?
Yeah, he's not constrained to linear time. He's not constrained to just three dimensions of space.
Why should we have to believe? Who says this? Was it Peter? No, Paul. Paul said this, and why?
Well, Jesus said it himself. So lots of prophets, including Jesus, made the comment that this is the way in which God would redeem us.
But Nostradamus, he was a prophet, yet we don't consider him spiritual or religious.
Well, here's why. The vast majority of his predictions of future history have proven false. This is what Moses said. The test of a true prophet is someone who predicts the future and is never wrong.
Never
wrong. In fact, Moses was the one that said one mistake is sufficient to brand the individual as a false prophet. And if you could prove a false prophecy in the Levitical law, there is grounds for the death penalty. So the standard was pretty high. So, but, you know, and that's why Jesus made it a point to fulfill certain prophecies. He also made the point to make certain prophecies. He says, you'll know I'm the Messiah by whether or not this comes true.
I never can get the best of you.
Here's why. Can you get the best of the Bible? If you can't prove the Bible wrong, then it really is from the God that has set up a plan to redeem us from all of our sins, in which case we need to pay attention to its message.
So should I give myself a deadline, a year, 2 years, a month, and then say, all right, I give in?
Well, maybe 24 hours would be good. I mean, you never know what's going to happen on the freeway, right?
Yeah.
So why? Sure. No, I mean, I ran into those issues when I was a young man, just kind of going through the Bible and saying, you know, is this true or not? And once I realized it's true, I said, okay, there's only one rational thing to do. Give my life to the one that did all this for me.
And you've never turned your backs and you've never hesitated since then? You've never, you've just continued on since
that? Well, one thing it tells us in the Bible is when you give control of your life to Jesus Christ and say, I want your offer of redemption based on what you did for me on the cross, and I want your Holy Spirit to begin to transform me. The promise is the Holy Spirit will begin a work of transformation, but you'll never gain perfection. In other words, how you determine whether or not an individual really is a born-again Christian, what kind of changes has taken place in that person's life. And it's not so much behavior as it is desires. The promise of the Holy Spirit is He will give you the desire and the power to do the will of God in your life. And so when I signed my name in the back of a Gideon Bible at age 19, literally within 24 hours, I saw desires in my life I never had before.
You truly meant, when you signed your name, it wasn't a formality. You really, really felt it in your
heart. Well, what I like about the Gideons, they lay it out as a contract. I mean, you know, it's kind of like signing your life away.
In a hotel room.
No, it wasn't in a hotel room. It was in my own bedroom. When I was in school, I was given a Gideon Bible. So I remember signing my name there and realizing this is a contract between me and God. And it's a serious contract. In fact, I sweated for about 6 hours before I signed my name in the back of the Gideon Bible because I realized this is a life-changing contract I'm making.
But legally, you can always change your mind within 3 days. You can always...
Only in the state of California. I don't think that works in God's economy. Hey, we need to end. We're at the end of time. So, but hey, we want to talk afterwards. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the amazing day in which we live. For literally every week that goes by, we see incredible confirmations of the truth of what we see in your word, the Bible. And thank you, Father, that we can have that increasing confidence on a daily basis. But Father, I pray that each of us would act on that increasing evidence. Lord, that we would not only receive this information, but act on what we know to be true. And give our lives to you. Give our lives to you fully. And allow your Holy Spirit to begin to transform us into the character of Christ. Lord, I pray for each one of us here, Father, that as we submit to you, day by day we would radiate more of the character attributes of the one that came to us as a baby and gave us an example of humility for a period of a few decades and then sacrificed his life on our behalf. In Jesus' name, amen.
Last week when I talked to you about the lecture for the Astronomy Club, Orange County Astronomers, we decided on the lecture, a testable creation model, the testable creation. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that'd be good.